pet issues is that we adopt value systems based on popular culture, and those, the impressions and the understandings of those value systems are very often based on early Western culture, and I would say very much a Christian culture. In other words, the impression of life in a lot of different value systems is based on how does Christianity see it. And we assume that that's how Judaism sees it. Take love, take faith. I mean, faith is blind. Who would argue that statement that faith is blind? Right? So that's a common understanding. It's not true in Judaism. Faith in Judaism is not blind at all. It is in Christianity. The very word charity is a Christian word, not a Jewish word. The Jewish word is tzedakah. It's a completely different meaning. So we've adopted through Western culture, through English, through, you know, literature, and then through entertainment and a sort of pop culture, we've adopted and absorbed a lot of ideas that are not particularly Jewish. And we've lost quite deeply touch with what are Jewish values. What is the Jewish interpretation or definition of this particular value? And it's an area that we need to understand, firstly, that we have absorbed sort of foreign ideas, and we have to sort of reorient ourselves to looking for what is the uniquely Jewish value. Because if we think that all religions are the same and they really preach the same values and the same things, and it just gets down to the nitty-gritty politics of who's in control, then we're losing out the real respect for what each religion and which each identity actually speaks for. Yiddishkeit in particular, although it spawned Christianity, it spawned Islam, but when it comes to value systems, it has nuances that make it exceptionally different to either of those. Although there are some broad things that we share. We share broadly with Christianity certain values of life, values of the individual, which Christianity sort of, you know, even a value of a faith that God is not against idol worship, you know, which Christianity sort of moved away from paganism. We share with Islam a shared idea of monotheism in a much purer form than there is with Christianity. Islam went deeper into the monotheistic idea without any images, without anything, with no intermediaries really, which Christianity has. You know, the Trinity is heretical in both Judaism and Islam. So we share certain broad strokes, but nuance, we share very little. And one of those areas, without a doubt, is the idea of humility. I'll tell you a teaching from the Talmud, which so runs contrary to, really, I think, even intuitive logic when it comes to humility, but certainly the value systems as they would be defined within pop culture. So the Gemara tells us there's a teaching. Now, the way it used to work in those days, how did they study in Talmudic times? They would sit in an academy, and there would be like tape recorders, except they didn't have the technology for tape recorders. They had people with these remarkable minds and experts who would recite the Mishnaic teachings, which had been edited a few hundred years before, which were collected by Rabbi Yehuda Nossi and so on. And they would teach these teachings from memory.
Before it was written.
There was scattered writing. Yes, there was written. It was already written down. But it wasn't probably, we're going back 1600 years ago, 1700 years ago. There wasn't, maybe 1500 years ago, there wasn't, writing was not commonplace. You had the technology, but you didn't have the technology to replicate. So therefore, while you had sourced writings, it wasn't a common form of value. So most of the learning was memory. So you had individuals who were memorized, who had experts on every single thing, but they were mouthpieces. They didn't necessarily have the depth of understanding. Their expertise was not in understanding it, but more in repeating it. And they became like the open book. So they would share a teaching, and it was in order. The teachings are in order, so they would share the teaching, and then it was discussed. Sometimes there would be an argument about a word. Sometimes there would be an argument about the source of the teaching. You say, it's this person. I've heard that it comes from this sage, not from that sage. There would be discussions, there would be discussion on understanding it, limiting it, defining the teaching, and so on, which is how we have the Talmud. So at the end of the tractate of Sota, which we actually read about in the parsha last week, at the end of tractate Sota, the Torah the teaching of the Talmud that says that it teaches like this, that from when Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, from when Rebbe, the great sage of Yehuda the prince, died, Botla Anova, the quality of humility ended. You never really have quality of humility. And then when another sage died, the quality of Yiras Chait, of true fear of sin, that died. In other words, the paradigm for it, the truest, purest expression of it, is gone. So let's focus on the first one, because that's the topic that we're going to talk about. He said when Rabbi Yehuda Anossi died, the quality of humility went with him. That's it. Said Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef is the leader of the academy. Listening to the sage speaking, he says, no. He says, you're inaccurate. You cannot say that Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, with him, died the quality of humility, because there's me. And I represent the quality of humility. Okay? End of story. Okay. Well, I mean, what exactly is going on there, right? I mean, that's so contrary to... And everybody in the academy goes, yeah. That's right. Absolutely. There's Rav Yosef. I mean, how can you say that? Inaccurate teaching. You got the information wrong. Somewhere along your communication tape recorder, you haven't repeated it correctly. Because how can you say it's over? Here's Rav Yosef. He's very humble. And he says so himself. So what's wrong with that statement? What is humility? How do you define humility? What do you think is wrong with that statement? Lance.
Well, it's completely ironic in terms of what he's saying, right? So how do you define humility is...
Well, what does it mean to you?
It means that someone who's like achieved greatness or has achieved a lot of stuff underplays it, or not underplays it, doesn't go out and...
Humble about it. In what way is he humble? How does he express his humility?
How do you express your humility?
How does this humble person express their humility?
By not...
By giving back. By not thinking that they've achieved everything and there's still a lot that they're not doing, that they need to achieve.
So by focusing on what they still need to do, not by focusing on what they have done. Okay, that's one answer. How do you think a person expresses humility? By the way, can a great person be humble? Can a very successful, can a CEO of a company be humble? Can a Steve Jobs be humble? Can a Bill Gates be humble? Can a Barack Obama be humble?
I don't know if Steve Jobs was humble, but Bill Gates is definitely humble.
Why is he definitely humble?
Well, if you read about them, Bill Gates is a very quiet, doesn't shout and force his ideas on other people. He's open for discussion.
Really? Ask that to competitors where every single computer has Microsoft locked in and can't have anything else.
That was 30 years ago.
Yeah. So he's become more humble after he made a few billion dollars.
Now he's apparently very humble. Steve Jobs never got to that stage until he was about to die.
He is humble, maybe sharing or giving back. I don't know. Like,
so he's humble by
sharing your knowledge or sharing your... I mean, humble...
In a sentence. Give me a sentence of what is humble. How do you define somebody humble? What about somebody who's not successful? Somebody who's walking down the street. Somebody who doesn't particularly shine in anything. He doesn't really have a major life.
I think humble, you say a humble person is someone who's he's greater than he comes across. He's like a much greater person than he portrays.
He's a much greater, that's humble or the opposite of humble?
No, that's humble.
Also that's humble because you're
he's
great
greater
person,
than he portrays.
Playing,
he downplays it.
Yeah,
not so great. I don't know so much. He's self-deprecating. He knocks himself.
No.
Like, I didn't learn much in yeshiva, but you know, I'll try to teach something. I'm learning. This is not my strong point. I need to understand how to be humble. Okay, so we spent enough time trying to analyze it. I wouldn't say very successfully.
What do you think it is to be humble?
Well, I'm going to try and share with you what I think the Torah is telling us or what the Talmud is teaching us, but I'd like to know generally sort of our own impressions before I get into the Torah's idea. The Talmud clearly, Rabbi Yosef, for him to be able to declare his humility, is would be intuitively contrary to the quality of humility. So one of the great commentators on the Talmud is known by his acronym Maharsha, which means the Rabbeinu Rav Shmuel Edels. He was a sage in Europe, Poland. And Maharsha, who's a classic commentator on the Talmud, he's printed at the back of each Talmud and we study him. He writes that the reason Rav Yosef said that, despite its contrary quality to humility, is because Rav Yosef is focused on making sure that the teaching is taught accurately. And he's forced to actually say, this is not accurate because I'm humble. And I have the quality of humility of Revi. By the way, Rav Yosef, you have to understand, was one of the greatest sages of the Talmud. So that makes him one of the greatest sages of Jewish history. He really was. He was the leader of the academy. He was called by his colleagues, not like Sinai, but Sinai itself. He was called the Sinai. You know, he was such a repository of Torah. He was like Mount Sinai, but not like. They called him Sinai. Others were called like Sinai. He was called Sinai. He was known as Sinai. So you're dealing with an individual who, at every level, he's a very humble person. He was a very modest person. But here he comes out. Why, says Rav Maharsha? Because he had to correct the text. It's not correct. That's your job. Your job is in the academy to make sure that the text is being taught correctly. This text was not being taught correctly. And the best proof is that I'm here. But at the end of the day, it would seem a bit funny because we wouldn't expect a person of deep humility to acknowledge or even necessarily to be deeply aware of his own qualities. Like you said, you focus on what you haven't done, not what you have done. I don't spend time thinking about my achievements if I want to be humble, because that would make me arrogant, right? So let's leap to this week's parsha. I'll go through the story. It doesn't leap out at you.
What is the parsha this week?
Bahalotcha.
Was Bamidbar last week?
Bamidbar was 2 weeks ago. We're in the book of Bamidbar now, but Bamidbar parsha was 2 weeks ago, and we have a story like this. It starts off. Now again, when you read the Torah, you don't see necessarily the connection. I'm telling it to you, and now when you go back and read it, you'll see the connection right away. But you wouldn't see it if you just read the parsha. But basically what happens is that the Jews complain. They become moaners, and they're griping about this manna that doesn't have any real visual enjoyment and doesn't taste like certain foods, which they would like, because it tastes only like other foods, but not like certain foods. You know, and they have this whole issue with it. And they come to Moses, and they make a big taina and a big complaint.
Thanks, dude.
Oh, hello. Thank you. So they make a whole big complaint, and Moshe really loses it. I mean, he completely loses it. They want meat, and they want, he says, where am I going to get you meat? He says, where am I going to get you meat? We're in the middle of a desert here. I'm supposed to provide meat. He couldn't relate to the entire need for it. It wasn't even a question of getting it. It was a question of, like, why do you need it? And he says to God, I did not give birth to these people. He says, I cannot manage, thank you so much, I cannot manage the people on my own. He says, I simply cannot handle this people on my own. So he basically says to God, listen, either you help me out or I take my life. I can't handle this. I'm out of here. I'm out.
Do you have sugar? No.
No, just soy milk is good. I'm actually off milk right now, so that's perfect.
You're going to be very sweet today.
What?
Because you got all the sugar.
Oh, no, I also don't have sugar.
So God says, okay, gather the 70 elders. We have already from Egypt, there were the elders. 70 elders. Gather them, and I will transmit from your authority and from your inspiration onto them, and they will share the load of leading the people. They will be inspired by prophecy. You will not be on your own. You will not be on your own. Fine, so this happens, and the 70 people suddenly become prophets, become inspired. But then, all of a sudden, Eldad and Medad, two fellows who were not part of the 70 elders, start prophesying. Eldad and Medad start prophesying. Out of the blue, they weren't involved in this, they were not invited to the party, and they start speaking prophecy, God's word. To which Moses, trusted attendant, Yehoshua, who succeeds him, says, Moshe, lock them up. Moshe says, what, do I have the right to, if God wants to inspire people with prophecy, that's great. I wish everybody was inspired by prophecy. You know, I'm not claiming this credit to myself. I'm not taking this only for myself. Anybody who can be inspired by God is wonderful. Why in the world would I want to lock them up? That's a very interesting conversation and a very interesting insight into Moshe's personality. Because the automatic thing is, he's the prophet. He has the right to speak. Nobody else does. Moshe says, but he's inspired by God. And in fact, it would be my greatest wish to see everybody inspired by God. Okay. The next story that happens doesn't seem to have an automatic connection. But I'm going to tell you the background as the Talmud explains it, what the connection is. Eldad and Medad are suddenly prophets. These are like Tom, Dick, and Harry's. These are regular Joes. They're suddenly prophets. Moses' wife, Tzipora, says to her sister-in-law, Miriam, they're baking bread, pita, something. And she says, I feel so sorry for these guys. Miriam says, why? They're prophets. She says, yeah, but now they can't live with their wives. Now they have to separate from their wives. She says, Miriam says, what do you mean they have to separate from their wives? I'm a prophetess. I live with my husband. Why did they have to separate from their wives? They can't have sexual relations with their wives. She says, why not? So Moses doesn't have sexual relations with me. Since the day he got the Torah, we are separate physically. We don't have sexual relations. So Miriam gets very upset about this. Miriam is Moses' older sister and had a big role in his development. She gets very upset about this. And she says to Aaron, who does Moses...
How old actually was she?
5 years. She says to Aaron, what's with Moses? Who does he think he is? We're prophets and we live with our wives. Like, why in the world does he think he's holier than us? And he somehow has to be like celibate and living some sort of abnormal life on his own? And Pur Zubar can't have relations and have a normal family life? That is the conversation. And God appears. A cloud comes, descends on them. The presence of Hashem comes in. And God says, you just spoke about my servant Moses. How dare you speak about my servant Moses? I speak to him face to face, not through images, not through allegories, not through dreams, not in sleep, but face to face like a person speaks to his friend. And you dare to speak against my servant Moses? That's a quote from the Torah. What is God saying? You're right that you as prophets don't have a restriction, but Moses does have a restriction. Because I appear to him at any moment, and he has to be ready every single moment to greet the divine presence. He can't be in a state that it wouldn't be appropriate. And in fact, we find the reference when God gave the Torah. At the end of the experience, it says that God told Moses to tell the people to go back to your tents, which is a metaphor, a euphemism for sexual relations, which they had separated from a few days before Sinai. So they wouldn't be impure with seminal discharge and so on, which creates a certain level of impurity. So he says, you can go back to your tents, which means you can go back to living a family life. But you, says God, you stand here with me. That's a quote from the Torah, interpreted as God's telling Moses, you don't go back to family life. So Moses didn't do it on his own. But Miriam spoke Lashon Hara. And the Torah says, V'ha'ish Moshe anav me'od mikol ha'adam asher apnei adama. And this man, Moses, is the most humble man of any human being, not just Jews, any human being, that stands on the face of the earth. That's it. So the Torah testifies that this was unwarranted talk. This is Lashon Hara. When the cloud departs, Miriam finds herself completely stricken by leprosy. She has to leave the camp for 7 days, and the people waited for her until she actually could return. So what are we talking about here? This is what we're saying. That suddenly, we learn about Moshe a certain number of insights. We learn about him that he has a level of prophecy that there's no precedent and there's no replica. He is different to every single prophet, and in Jewish faith, that's what we believe. He's called the father of the prophets, and his quality of prophecy is different to everybody else. Which is why his family life was affected. He lived differently than everybody else. It drew out from Miriam, Lashon Hara. She spoke badly. She had no right to. If she was concerned about what should she have done, she should have gone to Moses and said, what's going on? Why are you living like this? Why are you taking this advice? You said, not me. God told me this. You know, and then that would have been fine. But she didn't do that. She spoke to Aaron. And that's Lashon Hara. And we can realize how serious Lashon Hara is. If that type of comment elicits the type of reaction from God, I mean, we're guilty of that a million times a day. We have to be very careful. That type of comment against somebody else is negative. There's no value to it. If you're upset about something, go to the person. If you don't want to go to the person, say shtum. What are you talking about it for? To what value? To what end? To what purpose? So that's distracting from the point. The point is that the Torah testifies that while Moses is the most successful Jew in history with a relation with God that nobody else has, he is also the most humble. Now think about this. Who wrote the Torah? Hashem wrote the Torah? He took his hand and he wrote the Torah? Who wrote the Torah? Moses. So who wrote those words?
Moses.
Who wrote the words that it says, "Vayish Moshe anav mod mikol adam asher al pnei adamah"? The man Moses is the most. Moses wrote those words. You gotta wonder something. I mean, and how really can you be so humble when you're so not only so great, you're powerful? Moses was not a meek person. I think the way we associate humility with a certain meekness. And by the way, that's not far off. I mean, even Rashi in his commentary on this verse talks about Anav, he defines it as being shafal, which means lowly. Lowly of spirit, like, you know? But Moshe Rabbeinu goes to war. I mean, he goes to fight against Pharaoh. You think he walked up to Pharaoh and said, "Listen, maybe if I can suggest, you know, I just have something to discuss with you, if you don't mind, have a moment." And he's stuttering at the same time, right? He didn't do that. I mean, he's powerful. Moses is a booming personality. He is not this, he's a prince of Egypt. He didn't grow up as this Nebuch, you know, who's like sort of trying to find his place. He grew up with royalty. He grew up with confidence. He speaks to Pharaoh like equals. He speaks to God like equals. He fights enemies. He takes on mutinies. He's a very, very powerful character, Moses. So you say, listen, okay, to be a powerful character like that is necessary, but you can't be humble. You can't have both qualities at the same time. And yet the Torah is telling us that you could. How's that possible? Where does the humility draw itself? If you are great and you are genuinely great.
But he's writing that he's great.
And he's writing that he's great. So he's very self-aware of his, not only of his greatness, of his humility. He's writing that he's humble.
But was he writing that he's humble? Wasn't he?
God dictated. He didn't decide. Yes.
So it's not him. But he's writing down what.
That's true, but it's a bit of a weak excuse.
Not really. I mean,
God told me to tell you that I'm humble. It's true. God told him. But at the end of the day, how can you write about yourself that you're humble? It's a contradiction in terms. It would seem. But Rav Yosef in the Talmud doesn't seem to see it as a contradiction in terms. He seems to be able to publicly state his humility. And it's accepted by the Talmud writes it as recorded as a fact. It doesn't record it in ironic terms or any pushback or anything like that. This is the idea. You can be humble and know it. Not only do you know you're great, you know you're humble. So humility is not a lack of self-awareness or an ignoring a part of yourself or some sort of faking or feigning weakness or feigning inadequacy. It's something else. What is it? So the Hasidic interpretation, as is brought down in commentary on the Zohar, by the Tzemach Tzedek, they write like this, that basically the essence of humility is the knowledge that your greatness doesn't stem from yourself. The essence of humility is knowing that what we have and what we've achieved has not been simply through our own efforts. In other words, the idea of a self-made man is a myth. It is an idol worship. It is the height of arrogance to say I'm self-made. Because the truth is that if one thinks about it on many, many, many levels, we are products of a train, of a journey that we are almost just riding. Now, that's not to say that we don't have areas of achievement. It's not to say that we don't have areas of success. It's not to say that we have areas that we have done something about. The Torah wants you to work 6 days a week. It values input. It values effort. It wants you to work on yourself. It values change, growth, transformation. However, all that being said, could never have done it on our own. That's the truth. So, like I gave a Yom Kippur sermon a few years ago. Actually, you asked me for written, and I never did it. I spoke about the piyut in the.
You might write down your sermons before.
Not usually. Some notes. I don't usually write them down in longhand. I used to 15 years ago, but I stopped. It's a question of time. But anyway, let's not get into that. But yeah, so I did have notes on that, but I never wrote it. It was about the piyut where we talk about like the material in the hands of the potter who forms it. It's a beautiful, beautiful Kihine Kachomer that we say on Yom Kippur night, Kol Nidre night. And I went through it and explained the idea of faith in God and the idea that recognizing that ultimately we are a product of a genetic code, of a historical code. There's so much been programmed in us that for us to take credit for it is simply ignoring you know, things that we've been essentially designed to do. That's not to say that we had to do it. It's not to say that we had nothing to do with it. But to think that we did it on our own is completely unreasonable. I mean, even like illness and health is largely not up to us. I'm going to have good teeth, not because I take care of them, because genetically I have good teeth. I inherited good teeth from my father. You know what I'm saying? That's the bottom line. Somebody else is flossing every day. They're making themselves meshuggah, and they're having crowns at the age of 35. Me, when I don't look at my teeth, my dentist gets angry with me. But you know what? He's angry with me because I don't give him much business. And I'm not doing much for it. It's a genetic. I can't take credit for that.
It's your chemical makeup. Because some people
there's a lot of genetic.
And
the truth is that we go through the genetic. The more we know about genetics, the more we know about DNA, the more we know that there's a lot programmed within us. So in other words, to take credit for everything is unreasonable. So Moshe Rabbeinu understood that he was a unique soul. You know, I mean, I heard from the Rebbe a few times. I didn't hear it personally, but I know people who... I've seen a letter from the Rebbe, a note in his own handwriting. Not everybody can be a Rebbe. Not everybody can be the Rebbe. Not everybody can achieve these things. And the Rebbe said that to people. It's a unique quality. I don't believe that every human being can reach the Rebbe. I don't think everybody should aspire to be Rebbe. A Rebbe is born with certain soul qualities that really mark him as unique. But he can't take credit for them. He can know that he has these qualities, but to take credit for them is a very different story. And that's where you can get the dichotomy of being overwhelmingly present and yet completely, completely not about you at the same time. Those two qualities can be completely true. There's a beautiful essay by Lord Jonathan Sacks. You Google it. On this verse in this week's parsha, where he talks about humility, and his example for it is actually the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Because when you he went quite a few times to the Rebbe as a student, and then later, the Rebbe guided his entire life journey. From a student to going into becoming religious to becoming a rabbi to then working in Jews College and training rabbis to becoming a professional rabbi. The Rebbe literally guided him, and then eventually he asked the Rebbe for a blessing whether he should become chief rabbi, and the Rebbe, you know, gave him the blessing for it. Otherwise he wouldn't have done it. The Rebbe guided his life. So we're talking about somebody who has had a lot of interaction with the Rebbe from a very, very young stage in his own development. And he said when he stood in front of the Rebbe, he says, "You were the only person in the room. It was all about you." He says, yet the Rebbe's presence filled the entire room. He says, it was the dichotomy. It was all about you, and yet it was an overwhelming presence in front of you. Go look at his wording is always better than I will ever do it. He's a remarkable, he expressed himself very well. But this idea of humility should never be confused with meekness or a lack of confidence or acting in a way of... You know, the Christian value of turning the other cheek. It's not a Jewish value, turning the other cheek. I mean, there are times, there's definitely a value in not responding to every single accusation or attack, of not jumping out at everything, of allowing people to rather be those who insult you and not to insult them back. There's a lot of values like that. But meekness in a practical sense of just accepting clops and not dealing with them and not responding to them and not Jews are not like that. We're not wired that way. It's not a Jewish quality. When Bibi Netanyahu stands up in Congress and forcefully argues, people say he's a terrible person. Who gives him a right? That's a Jewish quality. Somebody's attacking me, I'm going to go talk out. The Pope comes to Congress, spoke to Congress. Lovely guy, beatific fellow. I mean, the man is a good person. He's not a bad person. But did you hear one word asking America to protect Christians who are being slaughtered in the Middle East? Where Christian populations have been almost decimated to zero? One after the other were being beheaded on camera for being Christians. Has he gone at nothing? To me, that's evil. To me, that's cruelty. How can you not stand up for your own people? It's because it's a Christian thing, I think. I actually asked the Pope, not a Pope, a bishop about this. More than one. And I've never gotten an answer. Like, what value is it that you're saying that you... Why doesn't your Pope stand up for Christians?
But he's Catholic. Does he even see them as being the same?
Yeah.
Because most of the Christians in the Middle East are not Catholic. The only ones who are really Catholic.
Maronites. They're Maronites, I think, no? Or Catholics. Yes, but I think at the end of the day, the Pope is...
Yeah, things like that, but not really...
No. But the Pope, yeah, there is definitely a connection to the Pope. And at the end of the day, they're definitely more related. They're being killed for as Christians. I mean, it would be like saying, "Listen, it's the guy who was murdered in a terrorist attack was a Reformed Jew, so I don't feel that it's not really against me." Hello, It's against Christianity. It's because it's a different form.
Look at how they behave in Jerusalem, all the different Christian sects. They hate each other.
Listen, so do we as Jews, but we still stand together when attacked.
Nowhere near as bad.
That's true. There's a lot of history there. So what is the point I'm making? That at the end of the day, it's not a Jewish value to simply take things lying down. And that doesn't, that contrary to the actual quality of humility. Moshe Rabbeinu understood and knew that he was a unique soul. No question about it. He knew that he came from the water, which he was drawn out of the water, which is what his name is related to, which Kabbalistically means that he came from a very deep level within God's presence, a very spiritual level without any... He was landed here like Superman, you know? Superman flies down here suddenly here. There's no transition period of accommodation and acculturation. You just, boom, from there to here. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu's soul never absorbed the rubbish of this world. It had a completely different way of looking. And I believe certain souls are born that way. Now, that's a very unique thing. It's a quality. Now, when you use it, you're simply using the quality you were given. So to take credit for it would be wrong.
Even for the mitzvahs, because the mitzvahs are free choice. But are you saying that a certain soul, it would be easier for them to choose mitzvahs than others?
Well, first of all, without a doubt. Okay. Second of all, at the end of the day, if you believe in God, then... yes, you have a free choice, but do you really have a free choice? Are you going to say, you know, I didn't kill anybody today. I had free choice. And guess what? A whole day went by. A whole day, and I actually got up early this morning, it was late. It was a long day. I didn't kill anybody. I had free choice. Clearly, that's not a question of free choice. Because your lifestyle and your living does not challenge you with that. So I can't get up in the morning and go to sleep at night and say, I ate kosher the whole day. I didn't step into McDonald's. I didn't even want to step into McDonald's. I can't do that. Why? Because it's not an issue for me. It's not a challenge for me. I have my challenges, my issues that I need to deal with. And those I need to be happy if I get through a day and don't give in to them, whatever they might be. And that's the way we have to grow. And by the way, if your issues stay the same for 20, 30 years and you got a problem, you're not growing.
Have the bull cut.
I enjoy it. Yeah. So the point being that Moshe Rabbeinu's humility was two things. Number one, he knew that the qualities he had were not his own. So therefore I can be aware that I have qualities, but I can't take credit for them. But I have to use them. So there was a Reform rabbi by the name of Herbert Weiner. I actually knew him. I met him. He used to be the rabbi of the largest Reform congregation in the East Coast in New Jersey. He was around, I think, Elizabeth. And he was a very, very, he was a very interesting guy, very deep intellectual. He was a rabbi there for like 50 years. And he was the editor of the Reform major publication. And he got involved and interested in mysticism. He actually was the one who popularized mysticism in Jewish culture. In the 50s, I'm talking about the 50s. I met him in the 90s. He was already an older man. He retired. And he went to Lubavitch as one of the mystics. He wrote a book called Nine and a Half Mystics, which is a great book. It's a really nice book, and he writes about himself as the half mystic. And he met the Rebbe. He went to Lubavitch. He wanted to learn about the Rebbe as one of his mystics. He was living in the New York area. He writes about a book by the different people. So he got to know Lubavitch. On a personal level, he interviewed my grandfather, who was like the only English speaker amongst the... my grandfather picks up language as well. So he met with him and they spoke about Lubavitch philosophy. My grandfather was a big teacher of Hasidic philosophy and a personality. So he met with him. The whole thing. Bottom line is, one of his articles he writes, he asked the Rebbe, you know, if you don't... does the Rebbe feel worthy? The Rebbe was a young Rebbe. He was in his 50s. 1950s, Rebbe was a young man in his 50s, he was the Rebbe. So he said to him, like, why do you do this? If you don't feel worthy to do it, why do you do it? So he said, what do you do when, the Rebbe said to him, what do you do when somebody gives you the keys and walks away? What do you do? So the Rebbe said, I've been handed the keys. I can either use them or I choose not to use them. Which would be a greater disgrace? I have to use them.
So
that's
then,
it all.
So then he is feeling worthy, so he's...
It's not a question of worthy, it's a question he has the keys.
When you say keys, the qualities.
The qualities, the opportunities to do it, the abilities to actually do it. He knows in himself that there are areas in his own personal areas of reflection that he feels unworthy. You know, he's hard on himself. He should be hard on himself. Fine. But in terms of why he's doing it is because he recognizes that he's been given qualities and he's been given abilities that lead him to do it. So he has to do it. And it would be wrong not to do it under those circumstances. The second element, well, this will conclude because we're getting late, but the second element of Moses' humility, says Chassidus, and this is what allowed him to be humble before every human being, By the way, there's some wonderful illustrations of humility, of his humility, which we're not going to get into now. But if you remind me, in Parshas Korach, which is coming up in like 2 weeks, I will share with you an insight into the Parsha of his humility that is mind-blowing, in my opinion, which the Rebbe actually innovated, which says a lot about the Rebbe too. It's a beautiful understanding of the verse. But okay, that's something we can talk about in 2 weeks. But Moshe Rabbeinu's other element of humility that allowed him to be humble before other people who do not have his qualities was to think that if those people had been given his qualities, they would have done a better job. They would have done they would have succeeded even more than he was. He succeeded, but not completely. So if they had been given it, who says that they couldn't have done a better job than I did? So therefore, the fact that they haven't done the job is not my strength. I don't know how they could have done. So it allows him to be humble before each individual who, had he been given or she been given those qualities, could have achieved even more than I've achieved. But it's not about ignoring or denying or minimizing your qualities or your achievements. On the contrary, you have to know what you've achieved, you have to know what you've accomplished, you have to know that you have more to accomplish, you have to know that somebody else might have done a better job, but you can never deny that you have qualities and abilities that another person doesn't have. I'll finish off with a quick story with interaction. The Baal Shem Tov taught that everything in life you have to learn from, every experience. There's nothing in life that you witness or that you encounter that you cannot learn a lesson in service of Hashem. Everything has a lesson in service of God. So somebody said to him, atheism is becoming dominant now. This is 1700s. So he says, there's waves of beliefs that there's no God at all. This was a new idea. Europe had never, it was like the world hadn't really considered the idea of no God. It was ludicrous to the world, as it should be. But anyway, that's the idea, is the winds that are coming around. He says, what can I learn from an atheist? He says, there's something you can learn from an atheist. He says, when you're walking along the road and you encounter somebody who needs help, there's nobody else to help him but you. You have to be an atheist. You can't say, oh, God will help. You can't say, oh, God will take care of it. You have to act as if there's nobody else, and you have to do everything you can to help that individual. That's what we learn from an atheist. In other words, you have to know that you have certain qualities and abilities to say. You can't be humble about it and say, well, you know, God will take care of the situation. No, you are the thing that God has actually given to take care of the situation. And that is the humility of Rav Yosef and the humility of Moses himself.
Yeah. You heard that story, like, is that it?